history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there that we need to hear. Sometimes it only takes asking the right questions and taking the time to listen, but we want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn so much. We're educated, we're entertained, often inspired by these members of our greatest generation. And this weekend, all across the country, Japanese American communities will be marking the 75th anniversary of Executive Order 9066 that paved the way for the internment of 120,000 Japanese Americans on the West Coast, and certainly brought angst and uncertainty and frustration to other Japanese Americans. And we're going to hear from a member of the famed 442nd Regimental Combat Team today who was not in an internment camp. And if you don't take the time to pay attention to this issue, maybe you don't even know that there were Japanese Americans who didn't end up in the camps. But that's the case for Sam Terasaki here in Denver, Colorado. And Sam, you must love this place because you were born here and you live here at age 92. Has it changed a little bit in those 92 years?
Oh, Colorado Boulevard had a gravel road. And I lived in North Cherry Creek area, which is probably the most sought-after area, neighborhood now, most expensive neighborhood in the city of Denver.
So Peyton Manning lives in your old house? Is that what you're saying?
Now, the road in front of our house was gravel. It was a strange neighborhood. One side of University Boulevard was the establishment of Denver, the Denver Country Club, and all the people who were prominent in the city.
Uh-huh.
On the east side of University Boulevard was made up of hardworking people that were in the working class, bricklayers, carpenters, plumbers.
Mm-hmm.
My dad was a merchant. He moved there on 4th and Clayton Street in 1922, I believe.
Not long before you were born. And did you have brothers and sisters?
Two brothers and three sisters, six kids altogether.
And where did you fit into that order?
The last.
You're the baby.
And I'm the last. All of them have passed on since.
I bet your big brothers must have toughened you up a little bit, though, huh?
Oh, they used to tease me a lot. But there was 10 years difference between my oldest brother.
Uh-huh.
12 years difference between the oldest sibling.
And you must have been in high school when Imperial Japan attacked Pearl Harbor.
Yes, I was. I graduated in 42, and that happened in December of 41. Graduated in June of 42.
So what do you remember about that? How did you find out?
And well, at that time, it was East Denver High School, probably considered the best high school of the five high schools in the city of Denver at that time.
A few more than that now, huh?
Quite a few, yeah. We had a student body of a little over 2,000. That's the 10th, 11th, and 12th grade. And on December 7th, for some reason, while they called an all-school assembly, they called, I think, three or four of us into the principal's office without telling us why. And we sat in the principal's office. Turned out that one of the speakers, and this was post-December 7th, the featured speaker that day was Mrs. Gates, whose family ran the Charles Gates tire manufacturing business in Denver. They owned a winter home in Hawaii, and she was in Hawaii, I guess, during the December 7th attack.
Wow.
Turns out, I guess, the speech was some propaganda that actually some things that she felt were going on that proved later on to be false, like cutting arrows in the cane fields and sabotage by the Nisei and stuff like that.
Wow. But you didn't get to hear the speech?
No, they didn't want you to. I didn't find out about the speech until later on.
So what did they tell you when you went to the office?
Nothing. They just asked us to sit there.
So they didn't want any students of Japanese descent hearing what she was saying?
Yeah.
Wow.
I'm not sure whether that was the reason or whether they felt there'd be backlash with our presence there or not.
Uh-huh.
December 7th, I was out rabbit hunting with my brother, one of my brothers, and his friend, Joe Morishige. who was killed in the war, I think in Italy or France. We went rabbit hunting with our 22 rifles, and it was a weird thing. We actually went around the outskirts of what was a new air base called Laurie Field. It had moved here from Illinois, and relatively new. I think it moved here sometime in 1937 or something. We didn't know anything about the start of the war until we got home. But in hindsight, I imagine three guys with rifles in a trying to tell officials that we were hunting rabbits when we're circling around a military base.
A base on high alert because they just heard that Pearl Harbor was attacked.
I don't know whether they were on high alert or not.
Wow. I know we're going to hear some stories that are going to amaze us at how you survived in Europe, but it's somewhat surprising you survived that if you're a young Japanese-American yeah. with a gun by an Air Force base. So then you get home, and you hear it on the radio, or your folks tell you?
Yeah. And then I don't know how long later, whether it was a day or 2 days or a week, but the FBI came to our home, interviewed each one of us separately.
Wow.
I was 17 years old.
You're a 17-year-old kid getting grilled by the FBI?
Scared as hell. And, you know, you hear a lot about the FBI, and I guess one of the big radio shows at that time was Gangbusters.
Yeah. Elliot Ness and all that. Yeah. What'd they ask you? What kind of stuff were they trying to get out of you?
I don't remember. I think most of it is just want to know if we were loyal and what we were up to.
And you had mentioned your father had done a lot of business with businessmen from Japan.
Yeah. So I'm sure that they didn't throw him into camp, but they did throw several, like the Buddhist priests, local Buddhist priests and stuff, were sent to a separate camp.
So December 7th happens, not long after the FBI comes to your home, interviews everybody, and I'm sure you're afraid of what's going to happen. But then a couple months later, the president issues this 9066, this executive order, basically saying that if you're a Japanese-American on the West Coast, you're an enemy alien, and you're out here in Colorado. Were you concerned that they were going to put you in a camp, put your whole family in a camp?
No, it never struck me. I really don't know why. Might have been because we didn't live in the Japanese community in Denver. We lived, I think there was only two families that lived in East Denver then. No, it didn't concern me at all, although I was aware of them being thrown into camp,
Did that make you angry to know that these people, just because of their last name or their appearance?
No, just wondered why. I wasn't really that political in those days. Now I'm a political junkie.
Uh-oh. When did you start to realize that you might be involved in this war that America had now been drawn into?
Well, I didn't face any discrimination for the few months later that I was in high school until I graduated in June of 42. Although some of the fellow students just maybe were afraid to get too involved with me. All of my friends were of Caucasian descent. A lot of my closest friends were actually Jewish kids that went to the school. I don't remember any of them ever coming up and say, Sam, don't worry, we're with you, and stuff like that. But on the other hand, they never turned their backs on me either. So I was fortunate in that sense.
And how'd you end up in the Army?
Well, I was drafted. You know the story about being designated an enemy alien.
Yeah.
Well, that's it. See, in 1942, I should have been drafted right away. I was 17, 18 then, 1A classification. It was in the spring of 42. They changed the classification from 1A to 4C.
Right.
I didn't fight it. I'm 4C, I'm 4C.
It didn't bother you that this country you're born in is calling you an enemy alien and unfit to serve?
No, I said to hell with them.
You just stay out of the way and keep your nose down.
I decided I was going to work a couple of years and go to university. Mm-hmm. If they wanted me, they have to come after me. I wasn't about to volunteer, mainly because I knew I had a hunch of where we would end up.
Really? What was that hunch?
That we couldn't join the Air Force, we couldn't join the Navy, couldn't join the Marines or the Merchant Marine. We were headed for the Army and the part of the Army that I didn't like. If I had had a chance to, actually, after I was inducted, I volunteered for the Air Force, but they went to. So I volunteered for the Navy. I hate ships, but I volunteered just to stay out of being designated infantryman.
Right. because you knew what that meant.
Yeah.
But you're saying you saw that coming. You figured that you guys would be the expendable ones?
Well.
Or that they were going to need some bodies at some point?
You don't want to go in the infantry during a hot war.
No. What about your brothers? Did they end up in the service too?
No, my oldest brother was the big source of income for our family. Then my dad went bankrupt during the Great Depression in 1929. Mm-hmm. His customers were the Japanese American community in the states of Colorado and Wyoming and Nebraska. Farmers who were initially worked on a railroad, but when the Transcontinental Railroad was finished, they ended up starting their own little farms as sharecroppers. And so he would import Japanese goods, didn't sell any perishables, but mostly staples, clothing, canned goods, things like that, and rice, and shipped it out to the different communities in Wyoming and Nebraska. And so my wife's family knew my family from that.
Mm. So we were talking about how you ended up in the Army. So when you are declared enemy alien, you don't mind.
So I worked for a couple of years in my brother-in-law's drugstore, and then felt that I had earned enough money to start at Colorado University, passed the tests, and enrolled in the spring of 1944. Paid my rent, had a room all to myself for $15 a month, completely furnished. While I was waiting for the quarter to start, well, I got my reclassification from 4C to 1A.
And what did that feel
so
like?
So I was, well, I didn't object. Called in. I got my deposit on my room rent and everything then. Was inducted in May of 1944. But one of the things that they were so hard up for replacements for the 442nd and the 100th Infantry Battalion is that from the day I was inducted until I first heard my enemy shell coming over my head was less than 6 months.
Wow.
Yeah, that was May of 44. Went to Camp Shelby, Mississippi for basic training in June of 44. And they sent us home for 2 week furlough. While I was home, one of the cadre from Mississippi, who was a Colorado boy, came home and called me up. And I knew of him, but I didn't know him that well. And he says, Sam, you better be sure and tell your folks hello, because as soon as you get back, you're going to be shipped overseas. That's first I heard of that. And it turned out that was the way it was. After my furlough was over, I went back to Mississippi, and they'd already had the mattress bag, fill it up. We were shipped out on a troop train to Camp Shanks, New York.
You shared with us how you were able to avoid the internment, your time here in Denver. You've got a couple of years of freedom that a lot of Japanese Americans didn't have.
No, they didn't.
But then you get to Camp Shelby, and you're around a whole lot of Japanese Americans who have been in the camps.
When I was inducted at Fort Logan in Colorado, there might have been a dozen in our group, I'm not sure. Half of them were people that grew up in the farm communities north of Denver, a couple of whom I knew. The other half came out of one of the relocation camps, Camp Amachi, which is in southeastern Colorado.
Right.
I made friends with one of the fellows that came out of Amachi. I didn't know him from Adam, and he lived in California before the evacuation. So we had a friendship until we both ended up in the 100th Battalion when we were shipped overseas. I was in A Company and he was in C Company. We survived France, and when we were shipped back to Italy, well, he was killed back in Italy.
Mm-hmm. What was his name?
Bob Suyoka. I have a picture of him, and I never have been able to locate any member of his family.
Really?
Yeah. Been back to, I visited Grenada, Amachi camp.
Yeah.
Once, tried to find out some information, but I'm sure he has some family somewhere in California.
If you did connect with him, is there something that you would want to tell him about him?
No, what a good-looking guy he was. But mainly to give him the picture of him.
And we're going to do our best to make that connection, but for now, it's time for our first break. 92-year-old Sam Tarasaki is our guest today. When we come back, he'll share his close calls from Italy with the 100th Infantry Battalion, part of the famed Gopher Broke Unit, the 442nd Regimental Combat Team in World War II. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.